This podcast is part of the MyPodcast.com network. Go online right now and get your very own 100% free podcast, MyPodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Scott Watson, and this is What Music Means to Me. In this episode, we continue our conversation with Dr. James Frankel, author of The Teacher's Guide to Music, Media, and Copyright Law. In part two, Frankel tackles many scenarios involving recordings and the internet, as well as the ethical dilemma before everyone working with kids in this digital age. I asked Frankel about the common practice of recording educational concerts.
You are totally allowed to record your concert and sell the CDs if, and I say in capital letters, if you pay the royalties to the publishers of that of those works. So, for example, if you were to record your band concert, you're completely within your rights to record the concert and sell the CDs, provided that you pay the appropriate royalties, which are 9.1 cent per tune per CD. You don't have to ask permission to just record the work as it is on the paper. If you make arrangements of it, if you do strange things with the work, then you need to ask for permission to do that.
Sure.
But just to record what's printed on the page, you do not need permission, but you have to do, you have to pay royalties.
Okay.
So, for example, my middle school, we ran a Battle of the Bands, and the students performed songs by the Beatles, by the Kinks and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. I recorded the concert, and I went to harryfox.com, and it doesn't matter whether it's less than 500. If you make one CD and sell it, it only makes sense if you think about it. If you're selling a product and you paid nothing for the product, well, that's a pretty nice profit for you, even
right.
if you're selling the CDs for 10 bucks. Obviously, the material that's on the CD is what people are paying for, and it's music. So the creators of that music are entitled to some of the money. So if you're recording a concert, you are well within your rights to charge for it, provided that you pay the appropriate royalties. And Harry Fox, although they charge a pretty significant premium to do so, mm-hmm. makes the process so easy. I strongly recommend using them. And what I mean by a strong premium or a high premium is that if the royalty is 9 cents, Harry Fox charges you a 9 cent processing fee as well.
Oh.
So it's about 18 cents per track, per song, per CD. However, if you do, let's say your spring concert, it has 10 compositions on it, you're talking about $1.80 in royalties. That's with paying the Harry Fox processing. It would be 90 cents without it. By the way, if I can just say that the reason that I would strongly suggest using Harry Fox is that they can take care of all the accounting for you. If you do it on your own, then you have to go to each publisher and send them checks on a quarterly basis, and I don't think any music teacher needs that kind of work.
Right.
So going to Harry Fox, it's a clearinghouse, and paying that extra 9 cents per track, in my opinion, is totally worth it.
Now, if an outside recording service is used, say you bring somebody in to record your concert and they're going to set up a booth in the lobby or whatever, are they responsible for obtaining the mechanical license, or is the director responsible?
That's an excellent question, Scott. And at every conference that I go to, and you see those custom recording kind of outfits mm-hmm. that are going to do that for you, I always ask them the same question, and they kind of look at me like I'm a police officer. I say, how do you handle the royalties? And their number one, or their constant pat answer to me is, it's up to the school. We don't deal with royalties, and the contract that we sign with the school, we tell them in the contract that all royalty payments are the responsibility of the school.
Okay.
All we do is make the recording. So it's a little sketchy, in my opinion, because if they're making duplications, which they are,
right.
Technically they're on the hook, in my opinion. So it gets a little, I have to tell you, the school, if they're going to sell the CDs, they need to take care of the royalties, and usually those recording services absolve themselves in the contract. And if a school signs the contract, then the school is totally on the hook.
Hmm. Last scenario I was going to ask you about is, this happens actually, I see this a lot myself, in the elementary teaching I do. Say on a Friday afternoon around 1:30, maybe the kids have had PSSA testing all week, or they've done something where the teacher wants to reward them, so they kick back, get some popcorn, and they're going to see, you know, the latest Disney animated movie for the rest of the afternoon.
Right.
Can you break that down according to copyright law?
Absolutely, and it's one of the most, it's probably the most common interface with copyright law that the entire American public has. And when you open a DVD for the first time or any time, when you plop it in your DVD player, the first thing that comes on the screen is a very annoying kind of blue or green and sometimes a badge. And it says very clearly, this video is, or this DVD is intended for home use only. You know, any unauthorized display of this, it is a violation of copyright law, and you know, $250,000 in fines and 5 years in prison. That is actually the law, and that's not there just to scare you, although it may seem a bit draconian. That's actually the law. So when teachers take a home use video and play it in a school, you're allowed to, but you're not allowed to play the entire thing. And you're not allowed to play it, and it's this is actually written in the law, you're not allowed to play it as a reward. What you can do, so let's say you take Disney's Fantasia, Fantasia 2000, for example, and you say to the students, I'm going to teach you about film scoring and how music relates to visual images. And so you play the video, like you take the first Sorcerer's Apprentice, and you play the piece without the music, and you ask the kids, what do you think it'll sound like? And then you play it with the music. That is a fair use. It's acceptable and totally legitimate.
You are
using it for an educational purpose. And even it would be considered a fair use because you purchased it for your home use. It's still a fair use to show that in your classroom.
Okay.
What is not legal is to take that video and play it for your class with no kind of educational frame or lens around it and just play it for a reward. And here is why. Very simple. Think about this. You have 32 students in your class, or let's say you're playing it for your band. You've got 100 kids in there, and you just feel like having a nice afternoon off, and the kids deserve a reward. So you play them Shrek 2, and you play the entire movie for them. You have just eliminated, possibly, the rental of that video or DVD, or the purchase of that DVD for every single student in that room. They know now they've
right.
seen it, and they don't need to pay for it. When you think of it that way, you go, oh, well, yeah, I've just eliminated the sale. And so the movie companies don't want you to do that, and I understand why. And if it's for no educational purpose but just to kill time, then you've got a problem if you do it.
So this whole discussion gets back to when you were talking about four factors of fair use. This is the fourth one, the effect of the use on the market.
And that's pretty much the main thing that when cases do go to court, and they're often in court over fair use. That's the stuff you hear about most often is somebody saying, well, this was a fair use. It's all about, well, did you make money? Did you make a lot of money? And what was the effect of your use on the original copyright holder's potential to make money?
Well,
so, yeah, I mean, to give you a funny example, Weird Al Yankovic's Amish Paradise, which he made a parody of I don't even remember the name of the gentleman, that's going to hurt, Coolio. Coolio did Gangsta's Paradise. Weird Al asked permission from Coolio's publishing company, can I record this? And they said, sure. They allowed him to. And so Weird Al recorded it. It was a parody, and parody is protected under fair use. And then Coolio saw that Weird Al was making millions of dollars off of the song that was almost note for note Coolio's song, just with new funny lyrics. And so Coolio sued Weird Al. Weird Al didn't win the case. It actually settled out of court. And I am, even though the results of the case are not known, I'll bet my house that Weird Al had to pay Coolio a lot of money.
Right.
And it's because that, you know, when money's on the line, the case and the issue changes quite a bit.
One thing that I want to point out is your book presents and embraces the idea of teachers as ethical role models. And I found this really refreshing because today the idea that teachers have a burden of responsibility to their students who look up to them, that posture is more and more viewed as antiquated or outdated and kind of quaint. And I thought it was neat that you're there with that with your book.
I think the main thing that I want to impress with that, for any kid, I don't care what day and age you're in, kids look up to their teachers. Students look to their teachers as role models.
Sure.
Whether or not we want to be in that position, that's a topic for another book.
Right.
But I always felt that, look, I'm a teacher. I'm actually held to a higher standard than members, other members of the public, because I'm in front of kids. And so I need to set a good example. And I hope that other teachers feel that way, because kids are extremely impressionable. And they spend more time with you than often with their
right.
own parents. So when I saw teachers in my own school that I was teaching in, downloading music illegally in front of students and thinking nothing of it, it horrified me. Because the kids are, and there's a great new book that I would urge everyone to read called Remix, Making Art and Culture Thrive in a Hybrid Economy. It's by Lawrence Lessig, who's my favorite author on the topic of copyright. And what Lessig starts his whole book out with is a question that's in my book as well, is are we raising a generation of criminals? And these kids that are the number one, or at least they're being portrayed as criminals by the recording industry, as, you know, pirates and stealers of music, and very often they are. If a teacher shows them, but tacitly, yes, this is an acceptable behavior, how are they ever going to think that it isn't? And so when that's really the point I was trying to make is, look, as a teacher, if you are up in front of kids stealing and tacitly then permitting it to students, teachers need to be role models, especially with this whole piracy and digital music downloading. They certainly can't be showing them how to do it.
I couldn't agree more. A phrase I like to say is more is caught than taught, and I think if we have a laissez-faire attitude towards things like this, the kids get that, and I think that was cool. But yet, on a practical note, you share that, for the most part, there are no publishers prosecuting music teachers for copyright infringement, and the story you told me about told us in the book about the 1976 lawsuit by FEI Publications against the Archdiocese of Chicago, that's a cool story. Mind sharing that briefly?
Absolutely. It's a great story. A publisher, I believe his last name was Fitzgerald, I'm trying to
yeah.
think, but I'm pretty sure that's it, was the most successful and largest publisher of liturgical music at the time. And he realized or found out that certain music directors in certain churches within the Archdiocese of Chicago were regularly photocopying his music and handing it out to chorus members or choir members to perform. And this is, you know, this is nothing new. But what he did was something very new. He decided to write a letter to the archbishop of the diocese to complain and say, hey, could you please tell, you know, your folks not to photocopy my music? And the reaction was, rather than sending out a letter to all the music directors to say, look, we really need to abide by copyright law, don't copy, the letter instead was, nobody's allowed to buy his music. You're all banned from buying any music from this publisher. What happened then is Fitzgerald found out about this and then sued, and rightfully so, because a huge stream of revenue had been completely cut off purely for him complaining. And so the case went to all levels of court. Fitzgerald won the first round, and then on appeal he lost, and then he took it again. And by the time the whole case was over, even though Fitzgerald won, I believe he won the last round,
mm-hmm.
his business was completely bankrupt. And by the time the financial reward came down for him, it couldn't even barely pay for his legal bills.
Right.
And so what that did for every music publisher, and I've talked to music publishers about it, they are in a really weird position. They cannot sue the people that buy their music, because if they do, they won't buy their music.
Right.
So they grudgingly tolerate all of the kind of abuses that happen on a daily basis in schools, and that's really unfair to the publishers if you think about it. Most teachers go, well, it's unfair to charge me such high rates. Well, you wouldn't be paying so much for music if everyone abided by the
right.
law.
They bought the number of copies they really need.
Right. So it's a catch-22 for the publishers, and I've talked to music retailers that people, I'm sure, have bought music from before, and they're in the same boat. They know that people are doing it, and they try their best to stop it, but if they complain too loud, they're afraid of the backlash that this poor Fitzgerald character suffered.
Yeah, and yet I do think that because of the internet and how connected we all are, there are some cases I'm hearing about that should put us on notice as teachers. For instance, I in one of the classes I teach for Villanova, a music notation class, one of the participants in that class is a high school band director, very talented arranger himself, and he had arranged a brief little transition in his marching band halftime show, maybe 40 seconds of music, and unfortunately had this on his website, of his band website, you know, what the program, what the repertoire they would be doing in their halftime show.
Well, what normally happens is that you would just get a cease and desist letter, which is the normal and kind of also known as a takedown notice on the internet. And you have to abide by that immediately. And often that's where it ends. That case that you just mentioned is actually not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was that he had arranged this music for his marching band to play in a halftime show or in a competitive marching band show. It wasn't that.
Now he's just crossed another line.
Right.
If it was just a recording of their published arrangement, then he would have gotten a cease and desist letter.
Right.
But because he took it one step further and arranged it, that's a great story. You know, and I think that leads me to this, Scott, is that it's amazing to me how many websites I go to, and now that we have the internet and many music departments are on it, a lot of those same music departments are basically waving a huge red flag for the whole world to see.
Right.
Check me out. I've got copyright protected music that I've posted without permission on my website. Come and listen. Oh, and by the way, I'm from the University of such and such.
Yeah.
And it is true that publishers pay people to go around and look for their stuff. And the internet is a whole other wrinkle in the copyright problem. And that's because it's accessible and then downloadable, and therefore inherently you're making a copy. When you post something online, anything online, you have just made it possible for countless people to make illegal copies without permission.
Well, and your book does give a great deal of attention to the ramifications of copyright in the digital age. The term media, for instance, could refer to a song arranged with music notation software. It could be an MP3 audio file. It could be a MIDI file, just to name a few. And how does copyright law keep up with all of these things? And they're constantly evolving. You know, there's new breakthroughs even now that are happening. So how do they, like the last law was what, 76?
Yeah.
So
and it probably will be. It probably will be the law for quite some time. There have been dozens of revisions to the law, or dozens of, not amendments, but acts that have been tacked on to the copyright law of 1976. And many of them are in direct response to new technologies. So, for example, right now in the courts, they're bitterly embattled over streaming audio and radio stations and the amount of royalties that they pay in order to do that. My favorite internet radio site of all time is called Pandora. And the royalty rates that are being, that the whole fight is over, would say to Pandora, for every single song that you play, you have to pay this amount of cents, even though it may seem minuscule, and would put them out of business. So, you know, streaming media, things like websites like YouTube, where almost, I would say that conservatively, 85% of the material on YouTube is copyright infringement. It doesn't matter what the year. If there's a TV show up on YouTube, it's copyright infringement.
Right.
And do I think there'll be another copyright law down the road? There will be. But it's a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of effort. And certainly I don't think President Obama right now, the last thing on his mind is coming up with copyright reform.
Right.
or another law. And so, yeah, it's kind of like a patchwork, and it's, you know, they keep putting patches on the dam until they have to build a new one.
What is the Creative Commons, and what's the purpose of the license that they issue?
Okay, Creative Commons, which was started by Lawrence Lessig, is actually, it's kind of funny, it's the two C's, and what instead of the one C in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Creative Commons license does, it gives you a number of different licenses, but you can say, this is how I give permission for you to use my work. So, for example, I have a whole bunch of lesson plans on my jamesfrankel.com web lesson plans and PowerPoints. And what I say to the people by issuing I put a no commercial attribute and non-derivative license. What that means is you can't make money off my material, number one. If you use my material, you have to say I wrote it. And that's number two. Mm-hmm. And number three, you can't make derivative works of my work without asking permission. So that CC license and the provisions that I make in it means that teachers can look at my stuff and I am giving them the permission, limited permissions, but permissions to use my work without actually having to reach out to me. And so LSIG's point with the CC license is, in the Copyright Act of 1976, one of the major additions was that any work, the minute it's in a fixed and tangible form, is instantly covered by copyright, whether or not you decide to get it formally registered.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is, and for the parents out there, when your three-year-old child puts finger paints on a piece of paper, that work, believe it or not, is copyright protected. So what the CC license does is say, look, I know what copyright law says, but I'm giving you permission to use this. That's why I think that teachers should be CC licensing all their materials so that others can use it, but making sure that the teacher says, well, you can use it, but please don't say it's yours, and please don't make money off of it.
Mm.
But the funny thing, Scott, is that the CC, even by putting it on, you're still covered by copyright law. You're not dismissing.
You're not yielding or waiving.
Actually, uh-huh. You cannot waive your copyrights. But the CC is saying, I'm giving you permission to use it so that that others can. It's kind of like a fast way of getting permission from the composer to do the arrangements.
Are you aware of anybody using a Creative Commons license for other creative work besides things like lesson plans and written material?
Sure, there's a lot of music out there that is being used. Yes, a lot of hip-hop artists and the youth culture that's doing remixing and mashups, a lot of them, if it's original work that they're remixing and mashing up,
mm-hmm.
They're releasing it with a CC license. And one of the most well-known is David Byrne, the lead singer of Talking Heads. He released a track in a Wired magazine issue. In fact, Wired magazine put out an entire CD of music that was a CC license.
Oh, cool.
Another example would be, even though it's not a CC license, but it's the same type of concept, is when Radiohead, which is one of my favorite bands,
mm-hmm.
put out one of their tracks for everybody to remix. It was a track called Reckoner. And a lot of bands are doing that now. They're releasing songs, allowing others to remix and mash up, kind of lending credibility to that entire culture, which a lot of us, I don't know about you, Scott, but I'm just about to hit 40. And I don't get the whole remix mashup. I watch it, but I don't.
Well, I'm too embarrassed to actually admit that I don't know what the term mashup means, to be honest with you.
Mashup is when you take like existing pieces of work and layer them on top of each other. The most well-known mashup, it's actually on YouTube and it's a copyright infringement. They took a song by Snow Patrol and Don't Every Breath You Take by The Police,
mm-hmm.
and they put them together at the same time, and it's incredible. They layered the two songs on top of each other, and that's a mashup, and it's incredible. And a remix is you take an original work, the original recording, and add new bits to it,
right.
and kind of pull stuff out of it.
Boy, I'm learning a lot today. Well, the last question I was going to ask you, first of all, let me ask you, is there something that we haven't touched on that you think is something our listeners, who I assume are mostly music educators, should be aware of that we haven't touched on?
I think the main point I wanted to get across with the book, Scott, and I don't ever want to come off as though I'm scolding anyone. The point of the book was to educate teachers what is legal, what isn't, what's an infringement, what's the rationale behind it, and what you can be doing in your classroom to kind of set a good example for your students and easy ways for you to do it legally, but also telling teachers, look, you've got a hard enough job to do. Teaching is a difficult profession, and pretty much every use of the materials that may be an infringement, the basis for doing so is almost always for good.
Right.
And if you're informed and you're still doing it, well, at least I've at least told you what the rules are, and you go ahead and make your own decisions. I'm not telling people what to do in their classrooms. I'm just telling them what the law is. And I want people to know that I'm certainly not coming from a higher than thou kind of position. It's just I think it's incredibly important in today's society, with the amount of new media that's out there for teachers to understand what is infringement and what isn't.
And you don't just carp from the sidelines. You have a whole chapter where you give educators legal ways to accomplish the same kind of curricular things that they were going to do that maybe they were stepping over the line copyright law-wise. You know, there's a legal way to accomplish those same things, and here are all those, here's 20 lessons that shows how to do it.
Right.
Just say I'm a high school music theory teacher who wants to show kids how the chord progression 2-5-1 occurs in all sorts of music. So I find a Bach chorale recording of a chorus singing, and I just take a 20 to 30 second clip of that, and then I take a 20 to 30 second clip of a Philadelphia Orchestra playing Enigma Variation.
Right.
And then I take another 20 to 30 second clip of a recording of Satin Doll, and on and on. And I put that on a CD, and I hand it out to everybody in my music theory class. Is that a fair use?
It is, and here's why. It's because you're using less than the 30, you know, that less than 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You're not, if you think about the fourth factor of fair use. By the way, and this is very important, that fair use is actually up to the individual judge in the federal court in your district.
Wow.
If a judge deems that your use isn't fair, then it isn't. And if another judge in a different district says it is, then it is. It depends which judge, believe it or not, the people that wrote the copyright law when it came to fair use, obviously, when fair use is being included, movie companies, publishing companies, and books and all, they must have freaked out and said, hey, you can't do that. You know, we want some kind of protection against this. And so that was the protection. Is that it's up to actually a judge to determine whether or not the use is fair.
The fact that every local judge has the power makes a great case for bribing and payola. No, just kidding.
Well said. That's good. But in the example that you illustrated, you're not actually going to eliminate the sale of those pieces by using them to illustrate your point of a 2-5-1 chord progression. In fact, you might actually spur the kids to go, well, what was that?
Right.
Hey, you know, Mr. Watson, Dr. Watson, what is that? And then say, oh, well, it's the Enigma Variations, and they may go out and buy it.
Right.
But by including the entire piece, you've just eliminated the need for them to go buy it.
The last question I would ask you is just, have your parents seen the book?
Yeah, my parents are really proud of it. My mom immediately said, oh, I don't like the way you painted me in the opening of the book. And actually, I really took it the other way. I really applaud my mother for having the foresight to, by her having that 1970s parent mentality of, I'm going to teach this kid a lesson now, I thank her for that. And I tried to explain that to her. She's like, well, I come off sounding kind of bad. And I don't think so at all. I really appreciated that long term. I certainly, when I was four, I didn't appreciate it very much. But as an adult now, this is a whole other topic. I think that that style of parenting is too infrequent. I don't think there's enough of that today. So I'm certainly going to impress that upon my kids that you know, stealing and other crimes, no matter how innocent they might seem, or no matter how innocuous it might be to click a mouse and get some content and think that you're not really hurting anybody. I think that the parents really, and teachers, need to impress upon kids what's legal and what isn't, and what's right and what's wrong.
Well, The Teacher's Guide to Music, Media, and Copyright Law by Dr. James Frankel is published by Hal Leonard, and I just think it's a great resource. It's comprehensive, it's relevant, and it's a very readable book, so I hope a lot of people I hope it'll be on every music teacher's shelf. Dr. James Frankel, thank you for being my guest on What Music Means to Me and for sharing your unique perspective on copyright law.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on the show, and thanks. You're in my dedication, because you were certainly one of the people that helped get this book done, and your role as the Time Publication Committee Chair. So thank you, Scott, for getting this project done.
Oh, sure thing.
I know you have a lot to do, so thank you for taking the time to learn What Music Means to Me. I hope music is and stays a part of your life. Until next time, stay in tune.